environment, and there will be a measurable amount of water vapor inside of that weather sealed, rubber sealed package. Is that approximately what you're saying, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet? Are you there still there, Glenn?
Gee, Dick, you got to speak longer. When I go downstairs, to at least change my clothes over in the dryer. But, yes, that's exactly right. You know, here again, most aluminum electrolytic capacitors aren't as tight as we'd like them to be. There are certain ways of manufacturing them where you can certainly get better seals on them. There's certain military designs where aluminum electrolytic capacitors were used and are used in special enclosures to really reduce this factor. Sometimes even pumping things inside like nitrogen to get around this sort of thing. So, yes, they can be used, but here again, it's one of those things where, you know, it's something you want to keep your eye on. And there again, if I ever had, in my equipment, if I found an aluminum electrolytic capacitor that really didn't read right anymore, would I really go through the trouble of trying to reestablish it and then use it for long-term use? I don't think so. It is interesting, and I've done it, where I've taken an old piece of tube gear, put a Variac on it to bring it up slowly just so I can get things operating again, make my measurements, see that it's a good working, you know, which circuits are working, which ones aren't, what needs repair, and then once I get past that point, if I see an aluminum electrolytic that really required some recharging, I'll go in and I'll replace it then, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And to expand with a question.
2HWW.
Yeah, we've got John, Howie, and Wesley in that order. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead.
Dick, my question was on a different topic, so you may want to pick up Howie and Wes first.
Go ahead, Howie.
Two questions on capacitors. One, what is the difference, price difference, if you're going from, let's say, a 16-volt cap to a 35-volt cap, and you're going from 5 to 10 microfarads, is there that much of a difference? I mean, if you're making millions of these items, it may be a difference. But I'm wondering, like when I work on stuff, and I used to design stuff for small companies and did my own consulting, I always, even though I may have had circuits that only needed, you know, could work with a 16-volt or a 35-volt cap, I always just use one volt because I said it was cheaper and easier for the people making the item because they wouldn't have to worry about, am I putting in a 35-volt cap or a 16-volt? If you got people, you know, stuffing a PC for it, you would just rather use one value, and I figured, all right, I made sure that I use a high enough voltage. That's the first question. Second question is this. I was always under the impression that tantalums had a lower leakage current than electrolytics. That I found out that when you wanted to do bypassing and you were using, you know, reasonable capacitance, 5, 10, 20, maybe 30 mics, that you were better off using a tantalum because of the leakage current. Wanted to know what QIQ had to say about that, Dick, and what's your opinion? That when you're dealing with leakage current or characteristics, I think tantalums are smaller and probably more reliable than going to, you know, electrolytic to, you know, metal caps. Go ahead.
Now, when it comes to properly selected and used tantalum versus aluminum electrolytics, which one is more reliable? I'm going to turn it over to Glenn eventually for that question, because I don't know. And which one has more leakage? I don't know. However, when it comes to, I see your intent to have one single style of capacitor that goes everywhere in the circuit, and that way you don't have to worry about people having a stacking problem and putting the wrong one in the wrong place. And my understanding is that if you needed 15 volt and you bought a 30 volt capacitor, that the 15 volt versus the 30 volt, there's rather little difference in cost, I believe. However, there is a difference in volume. A 30-volt capacitor versus a 15-volt capacitor might be two-thirds bigger, so to speak, and will your circuit tolerate a larger volume because of other constraints of where the printed circuit board is going and what's alongside of it and so on. So I am guessing volume is going to give you more grief than dollars when you go to the higher voltage. And so what we're finding about these tantalum-like capacitors is that if you think there's anything that's going to be aggravating, it's temperature as a function of time. If better set that voltage rating a hell of a lot higher than we used to if you really want it to last for 10 years. KC2QIQ for comments on all of the above. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Glenn.
KB1RFY with a comment on capacitors.
Yeah, I keep on hearing the voltage. I think we got that one down. Everyone seems to be on the right page as far as that's concerned, that, you know, selecting a much higher voltage rating for capacitor life. But the one item I don't hear coming back that people talking about is temperature ratings on capacitors. You know, when you talk about aluminum electrolytics, you can buy them at 85 degrees C, 105 degrees C, 125 degrees C. And a lot of people are like, well, my device sits in the room at 25 degrees C, and why do I need an 85 degrees C capacitor? Should be really good enough. I can tell you from experience that just even looking at ham radio gear, I've thrown thermocouples inside these things without fans on them and other things, and just even in the receive mode, I've seen temperatures inside the box of transceivers well into the 40s and 50 degrees C inside the box. It's amazing the temperature rise you get. One thing, if you really want to make circuits that are going to last a long time, try to go for the 105 degrees C caps. Moving that temperature rating on the cap up will buy you an awful lot of capacitor life. Dick, back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, it's current.
Glenn, what do they do differently to make the capacitor rated for a higher temperature? What changes?
Well, typically it's the dielectric spacing in the electrolyte. So the electrolyte itself is actually rated in a larger spacing area, and the dielectric is actually a little bit thicker. So when you're looking at higher temperature caps, they're usually quite a bit, they don't necessarily go up. Like if you're looking at a 25 millimeter or 1 inch tall capacitor, typically, at 100 microfarads, the diameter might be like 5 to 7 millimeters. When you go to the 105 degrees C cap, you'll see it'll be like a 10 or 12 millimeter diameter. So the diameter definitely gets bigger on them when the temperature goes up, when the temperature ratings go up. And you'll see a similar effect also with voltage. But temperature ratings are very, very important. Leakage on capacitors, a good capacitor operated well within its operating range, whether it be, you know, ceramic, aluminum electrolytic, or tantalum, should have minuscule, I mean, 10 to the minus 9th, you know, even smaller than that, leakage current tally. So if a capacitor is operating in the right range, I wouldn't worry about leakage currents in capacitors. So I think that's, let me just let this drop once quick.
What do you think is a better cap for bypassing? Electrolytics or tamper? I always thought tamper were the way to go.
I got a comment on that.
When you say bypass, Howie, what do you mean by bypass? Are you talking about like a DC filter, or what exactly is the, when you say bypass, a couple more words.
Yeah, let's say an op amp, a 5532. Okay, and I want to fill up there in Connecticut. And let's say I'm coming off the B-plus line. I'm right at the B-plus pin. I might put a 1 mic or a 2 mic to ground for every couple of op amps, or I put a cap right at the B-plus lead, or if I got a bunch of TTL gates, or the input to a board. We're not talking about filtering. I wouldn't use samplers for a filter. But if I'm trying to bypass... If I'm trying to bypass something, and I wouldn't use a tamper for timing, obviously, or for an RC network, but I'm talking about the general purpose, trying to make sure they have no glitches or spikes getting into my equipment.
There's a manufacturer of tantalum capacitors called Chemist, and for that kind of bypass, if the temperatures of the board really don't go above 50 degrees C, in which if you put thermocouples on things, and you can see that nothing in the life of that capacitor will ever go between, say, 45 to 50 degrees C max, I would say you probably can get away with tantalum up into the side of a corner in a control board, and they wind up with very, very poor cooling in a control circuit, and they're treated like a red-headed stepchild. It's completely ignored, and the temperatures on that board might go to 85, 90 degrees C. up in that corner. In that case, I would be definitely using a 105 degree C aluminum electrolytic on the board, and they make surface mount versions of that as well now too. Or you can even use other capacitors. I mean, there's other types there. You can get ceramics up to 10 mics now and deal with those high temperatures in surface mount. And also keep in mind there's the MMP type of metallized film capacitors that can be used there. So there's a lot of other choices in the higher temperature problems. Let me pass it back to Dick.
There's something very innocent happening when it comes to the temperature of our electronics. Case in point, my son, KC2IQN, has a laptop computer that after a couple of years use started giving him decreased calculating time and speed. It was going into some kind of a protect mode. And we all forget about the fact that every one of our laptop computers, with rare exception, has got a fan inside. And yeah, the fan is nice. The key is sending cool air through there. But whenever there's a fan, you're always sucking in dust. It's just a matter of time before there's a pileup of dust somewhere inside, and something is going to run a hell of a lot hotter than you know about. Although it's very difficult to take them apart, he took apart his laptop computer, got all that dust out of the corners, put it all back together again, and it was back to full speed operation without these interruptions, without these slowdowns, where the microprocessor was going into a self-protect mode and slowing down his computing because of the temperature it was going to. And I guarantee some of those things are going to some very high temperatures. So I'll bet you some of our laptop computers that we think are going to last forever are running into some pretty high temperature problems from time to time, and based on that experience. I think that the next person was John, KC2QIQ, KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
And where's the authority question?
Dick, you have a guy up in Connecticut.
Okay, Dexter, KB1, Foxtrot Yankee. And it says you're in Lowell, Massachusetts, and if so, you're a DX station. Go ahead, Dexter, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I'm not Dexter. It's Kilo Bravo, 1NDF Fox Yankee. The name is Bill. My experience with those capacitors were, I worked at Translux. I worked on the Telex units. 99% of those capacitors either came shorted or they were, the polarity was wrong on them. And I also, you're talking about computers overheating. I had an HP PC tablet laptop that right after the warranty expired, the motherboard fried on it. The GPU unit heats up on that. I just thought I'd pass that info off for what it's worth to KB1IFY, Bill and Steve for Connecticut.
Bill, do you believe that overheating was created by insufficient airflow because after a year or two, dust was built up? And by the way, Bill, your audio is a little bit heavy. Please back off on that mic a little bit. Back to you, Bill.
I was waiting for the courtesy tone. Yeah, I actually did a Google search on the computer I had, that particular model, and everybody that's had that model or a slightly different model had the same complaint. The motherboard's fried. It was the GPU unit. And right after that, HP did not want nothing there. They discontinued the model and made another one.
But was the length of time for the frying possibly would correlate with dust buildup, 2 years downrange, and no one had ever taken them apart and de-dusted them. Almost nobody I've ever heard takes apart their laptops to get rid of the dust. But if continuous air is flowing through there with a fan, it's just a matter of time, depending on what environment you're in. Very few of us live in a clean room where it's completely dust-free. We all have dust in our environment, and it's piling up into our computers. You might have an opinion on that one, Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, actually, the computer was a year and 11 months. It didn't quite make 2 years, but, I think, no, you're right. Usually nobody thinks of taking them apart, but they also tell you to put one of those chill pads on them there. But, there's certain models, they run a lot hotter than others over there. And that, like I say, that particular one, everyone that's had that model or similar models had that same issue.
Okay, thank you for that. Wes, I know you had a further question. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN, I would suggest to take John first, but my nature of my question after John would be whether the genius was in mistake. Neutrino results change the modern physics by Italian experiment of this week, which is September 22nd. the new news is that Trino travels for one part of Italy to another part of Italy faster than light, and this is by CERN, European Science Agency. So it's not by Italian by itself. Back to you.
Yeah, that was a very interesting article that appeared this week. CERN, which is the group of people in Europe that are running the Large Hadron Collider, noticed that the neutrinos that traveled through the Earth, I forget what the distance was, 50 kilometers or some significant distance, the neutrinos were arriving 20 parts per million faster than the speed of light. Not a huge increase, but it's a significant increase. And they've apparently calibrated and recalibrated the equipment, and they keep coming up with the same answer. The neutrinos, and maybe the fact that they're changing flavor has got something to do with it, but the neutrinos appear to be moving faster than the speed of light by something like 20 parts per million. If that's confirmed, here we go with warp speed, science fiction, if you know what I mean. John, KC2WGB, K2RAW, go right ahead.
That was the topic I was going to bring up, Dick. There were two experiments made. The first one was made by Fermilab here, and that was in 2007, but they couldn't reestablish a proper format to prove it. But now CERN has the same results, so now they're going to collaborate. Also, they seem to have found the Higgs boson, and they're running that experiment again. So those are two big developments that happened out of CERN this past week. Excellent stuff that's going on. I was just wondering if you had read about that.
I read about the neutrinos faster than light. I didn't read about the Higgs boson, which I think is the main reason that they're using this huge machine in under Switzerland and France, I guess it is, the Large Hadron Collider. Large Hadron Collider. I think the main reason for it was the Higgs boson, and I believe that's believed to be part of where, is it mass or gravity? I think it's mass. I think the Higgs boson is supposedly what creates mass. Is that true, John? Tell us anything about what they've discovered. You've got it, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
It is related to gravity. They think this is going to give us an insight into how gravity actually functions. Now, if they have found this particle, what it's going to mean, I really don't know. I guess there's going to be a lot of algorithms written for this to see what develops. But it was just an interesting fact also about the neutrinos. I guess they can't really have mass, if Einstein's right. But evidently, they think they do have mass. So either, because as you know, as we approach the speed of light, the mass goes up, energy to get it going. And also, the physical size changes. It gets shorter as we approach the speed of light. So this is going to bring a lot of chaos into physics, I'm sure.
I once knew what the total price of the Large Hadron Collider is in CERN, Switzerland. Lots of money. Really big machine. One of the books I've got on the subject, I think I've got it right here. Yeah. Called The Quantum Frontier, The Large Hadron Collider by Don Lincoln. And it's a Johns Hopkins book. Rather nicely written book, which I bought apparently 2 years ago. 1969 is when it was published. Correction, 2009 is when it was published. And who's the publisher is Johns Hopkins University Press, Baltimore. So, if you're interested in the subject, you'll like that book. Reasonable number of pictures, lots of explanations on all of these very fancy detectors. Many of these detectors are considerably larger than a good-sized house. So, lots of hardware. And as you know, they had a big event, a year and a half or so ago, where a quenching took place, a bad contact on one of the superconducting magnets created an awful lot of grief. And I think they're slowly sneaking up to higher and higher energy levels that the machine is capable of, but they're doing it slowly, hoping to find all the other faults before creating any more damage. So how long ago was the Higgs boson announced? Where did you first find out about it? Back to you, John, on that one. K2RIW in the Tech Nav.
On information was actually, I found it on the web when I was Googling, and again, very interesting, and I'm glad that some of the return of money is going to be seen, because they were a money sinkhole, and people were starting to complain about it, especially with that major failure they had. A friend of mine who left here 2 years ago to go work on that system, he was over there for 6 months, and he was giving me sort of a visual layout, and for a 17-mile walk around, that thing is huge, and I have no idea how many billions of dollars that cost. Maybe it's in that book, Dick, but I'm sure they're not finished spending money there.
But that's the nature of pure research. You got to put lots of money into it, because we're really reaching these days, and what's going on is you go to higher and higher energy levels, you get further and further penetration into the nucleus, and therefore you start seeing smaller and smaller subparticles. That's my way of understanding it. There's obviously a lot more to it. Let me make sure that Paul, our space expert, has told us everything we want to know about what NASA is doing. If you're still there, Paul, go ahead with your report. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Doug. I was listening to John. I hadn't heard that report about the Higgs boson. Did he say that was confirmed, or would it? I know that's one of the main goals.
They're working on reconfirming it.
CERN.
I have your comments.
That was the main purpose, and other people were trying to, you know, come up with it before they had it built. But you know, this is the biggest one. So, is that true? Is that what John said? Is that confirmed that they got the Higgs boson as a positive, or is it, you know, it's just they got to look into it?
Negative, KG2QIQ.
I think it's a preliminary report requesting a further confirmation. Is that approximately true, John?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. They were doing the experiment for 3 years.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Glenn.
My understanding, Dick, is that the last three experiments that they did were actually very, very crucial, and both of them came up with, I guess from a calculations point of view, that if they were going to see it, they probably should have, and right now they're kind of rethinking things. Back to you, Dick.
So it's preliminary data, and it's not ready for testing all the way back to the Bureau of Standards, so to speak. Back to you, Paul. And so,
very comment.
No further word, if I understand correctly, Paul, on the parts from the upper atmospheric research satellite. And are there any other things that NASA is doing? Like, I think we brought three of our cosmonaut astronauts back down. I think there's only three on the International Space Station right now. And when is the next launch of either a Progress ship or a passenger ship? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, November, I think it's middle of November, is the next launch from Kazakhstan. Another Soyuz. We'll put three more people back up there. Still thinking about this Higgs boson thing. That would confirm this whole supersymmetry thing that they've talked about, whole model. I hope that works out. Like, you know, somebody said, they have spent many billions of dollars on this thing. I was working out at Brookhaven Lab, and that was only about 2.5 miles around. It was called the RIC program, Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. And I can't imagine 17 miles around. Wow. okay, very good. As far as NASA, I'm trying to think of the next flight. Last Progress failed. I guess they usually send them up every 3 months, so I guess one's probably due. I don't know what's going to come first, the Progress flight or the manned flight. to drop it. Okay. Dick, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to time this out, but no, I don't really have anything else. We talked about the new space launch system, I think last week or the week before, that 403-foot tall rocket, twice the size, over twice the size of the shuttle as it stands on the pad. They did build a new rolling, crawling type of thing for the Constellation program, which cost, probably another $1 billion. I don't know what it cost, but you know, it was completed, and it stands about six stories high. And apparently, this mobile launcher will now be able to be used. It won't be, they thought, well, here's another waste of money, but it's going to be utilized for this gigantic rocket. That I heard recently. Back to you, Dick.
I'm trying to confirm whether or not the Large Hadron Collider, you said is 17 miles. Is that 22 kilometers? I thought the number 22 was in there somewhere. 22 miles or 22 kilometers for circumference, and I haven't found the right chapter that says that yet. Does anybody know what is the circumference of the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, it's probably, if it's 17 miles around, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, I don't know, probably 5.5, 6 miles diameter, I would think. Probably 5 miles.
I think it's bigger than that. We'll eventually find that one out. And so, November is the next launch, and we still, in the United States, don't really have our own launch. Humans to the large, to the International Space Station. Is anybody making a rough guess when we will really start the serious program? Are we in the study phase right now, Paul, or are we really starting to build hardware for our own launch facility of humans? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, they're doing a friction welding on the Orion spacecraft. They're actually putting that thing together. That's going to carry up to 6 astronauts at a time. That's going to sit at the top of this thing. And then whatever gigantic habitat modules or whatever they might want to put behind them will be able to go up. And then, you know, you would undock with the whole setup and turn the craft around and probably dock with a habitat module and to launch you up to an asteroid, whatever they want to do. The capability will be there. You know, that's a similar setup to what they had in mind with Apollo. You know, you had the Apollo and LEM. They would go up together. The Apollo would separate from the stack and then turn around and redock. You'll have that capability. And, it should be good. I mean, you know, you might be able to even send it to the James Webb Space Telescope for repairs. A million miles out would be nothing for this thing now. So that would be good. I mean, that's an important telescope to keep running. I mean, it's not like the other infrared telescopes, like the WISE telescope. What is it? The WISE Survey Infrared Survey Telescope, I think that is. Or Explorer, they call it. I mean, that thing is, you know, when it runs out of coolant, which is helium, eventually that thing's going to die. That's done complete surveys of the sky in infrared. But Space Telescope, the James Webb, that will be phenomenal. Want to be able to keep that going.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You stopped at just the right time, Paul. We heard your last words before the timeout. Not to worry. The beginning of the book says $7.7 billion is the Large Hadron Collider. And quite possibly that's a slightly optimistic number, but it gives you a rough ballpark as the cost. We put $33 billion into the Apollo program in 1970. So the International Space Station, I don't know what the price of that is. I know that each space shuttle is roughly $2 billion. I think the Hubble Space Telescope was roughly $2 billion.
$100 billion for the ISS, Dick.
$100 billion. Whoa. However, that's being shared by a number of nations.
16.
16, did you say?
Correct.
Okay, so we're not handling the whole price of that one. Another point I was going to make, but I've forgotten it. So, when do you think, what's your best guess as to what might be the first fly date of...
Dick, 27 meters, 17 miles.
Okay, 17 miles is the circumference of LHC. Is that what you're saying, Glenn?
27 kilometers.
That's what it is, and it's about 175 meters, about just under 600 feet deep.
So, I think you're saying 27 kilometers, 17 miles circumference. Is that true, Glenn?
That's it, Dick.
Okay, 17 miles it is. That's a nice long distance. That's quite a walk. And you probably don't want to make that walk because when you run machines like this, the portions of it become hot. I remember the AGS, the alternating gradient synchrotron at Brookhaven Lab. I remember getting a walk around on that thing. I remember there were signs in certain areas saying, do not dwell here, because the machine has already created hot spots, so to speak. Anybody have any further comments on this one? K2RIW?
Yeah, 16.76 miles.
Close enough to, we'll call it 17 miles. That's a nice big circumference. And I don't think anybody is dreaming about a bigger machine than that. And by the way, when it comes to repair of James Webb, I'm skeptical of that one, Paul. You may be right, but where that particular Lagrange point is 1,000,000 miles away from the Earth, as opposed to the Hubble is something like 260 miles up, 1,000,000 miles. In the case of Apollo, yeah, it went 250,000 miles, which is not 1,000,000 miles. Think about that. Let me drop this. I'll let it time out because I can hear it. A quarter of 1,000,000 miles to the moon was nowhere near as much energy consumption as you think, because you looped around the moon. The moon gave you the turnaround, so to speak, and then if you didn't fire the retro rocket, do a orbital insertion burn on the backside of the moon. If you didn't do a orbital insertion burn on the backside, you would be just coming right back again, like a bouncing ball, if you know what I mean. Whereas when you go to James Webb, you're not going a quarter of 1,000,000 miles, you're going 1,000,000 miles, and there is no turnaround capability, so to speak. You have to supply the energy to get up to that altitude, and then you've got to supply an equal amount of energy to come back. I really don't think we're going to have repair capability of something that far out, Paul. By robots, just barely. With human beings on board, not a chance, is my belief. And yes, it sure would be nice to be able to repair and update James Webb, very similar to we've had, what, a total of six or seven repairs and updates of Hubble, and drastically improved its capability as the technology advanced. You'd like to be able to do that with Webb. Probably said it and I've forgotten already. Does Webb have cryogenics on board that are consumables, and therefore it will be decreasing in sensitivity once it uses up those consumables? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
No, it's not like the Herschel, which, you know, that has consumables, but the WISE, the infrared, that has consumables. Sort of like one big sunshade that they're going to have set behind this thing. So it's going to be, what, 3 degrees Kelvin all the time, and that's all they need. And no cryogenics whatsoever. And that's why it could last so long. They're looking at 10 years. With cryogenics, they'd be happy to, you know, maybe you get 3 years out of it. You can't stop helium. I mean, that'll come through anything. Molecules are too small, so eventually they bleed off. And that's how come all the infrared satellites eventually fail. Compton, Kobe, the Hope, all of them. Except for the one on the space station, the one that they put up there, I think a mission or two ago, that one will last also forever. That does not have cryogenics, and that's also infrared, so that's pretty good. And as far as servicing, let me drop it.
have a comment on that, Dick.
Cryogenics?
Yeah, I believe so. That was also cryogenics. I wonder if that mission is over, Dick. I don't know. I don't know if that mission is over yet or not. But as far as servicing, the way I look at it, I haven't read anything, or nobody's said anything about this. Not even been on the internet, but I just figure, well, you can go out 50 million miles maybe to the asteroids, even more, to an asteroid between the closest it would probably be 50 or 60 million miles. That's between Mars and Jupiter, and then turn around and come back. They could do that. They can go out a million miles with this humongous spaceship. I mean, it's got a lifting power 20% more than what Apollo had. Dick. So, you got this whole LEM that they brought to the moon and back. We're not going to be landing really anywhere. When you go out to the space telescope, you're just going to visit it, dock with it somehow, and well, that would be another problem, by the way, docking with this thing. I don't think it's being built to have any docking compartments, so they might have to invent something yet, Dick. They got a lot of years. 2018, I think, is launch date. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, John, you said you had a comment. Go ahead.
AC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I was talking to a friend of mine who was with JPL 2 weeks ago. They already have something in the thought process. It's going to be sort of like a rescue vehicle to go up to that point and bring the vehicle down to a lower Earth orbit to service it and then take a vehicle and return it. That's one of the ideas they're kicking around because they don't think it's going to be serviceable by robots.
So you're saying that they're in the talking stage of taking James Webb from a million miles out, bringing it back down to Earth orbit for service, and then bringing it back. That's what you heard there, John? Go ahead.
Yes, I did. And they were talking about it. It will also coincide and be coordinated with another mission. They don't know what that mission would be. And they could use it as a secondary to pick up that at that Lagrange point and bring it down. And then the vehicle that goes up to do the service or people would then use that same craft to put it into orbit back into the Lagrange point. Basically, that's sort of the idea.
Interesting. Doesn't sound easy. Because when you deploy James Webb, to make something unfold all those ways, occupy all of that volume when it finally gets on station and unfolds, to design all of that so that it can refold itself to bring it back down, wow. Doable, but sounds difficult. All of those sectors of that very precise chunk of mirror. Doesn't sound easy. Now, John, during Hurricane Irene, you did a very good job of running the tech net. Who did I miss tonight, John? And who's next up at bat that I should be going to?
Entrix here.
That's what I was going to say. The only one you missed, Wesley, had an additional comment.
You got it, Wes.
I had a few subjects. The essence of generating strong magnetic pulses. That's one of them. The other one is with the antennas, which you like very, very much. Let's go to the first one. The energy is compressed into the very short pulse. So you have a single pulse obtained in a small period of time. And is very powerful, but the power consumption is really relatively small. This is called power compression. This is how, for example, the Marx generator works. I don't know if you recall, a few months ago, we've been discussing Marx, M-A-R-X, M-A-R-X generator. Let me drop. Okay, no drop. Okay, the charge the battery of the capacitor, and then all of it, a single key discharged. By those, but the systems of which I speak use some little bit different principles. I know that many people listen to this conversation using a web page, so I will not explain the details because I don't want to educate or be a teacher for the younger generation of terrorists, but I will say that using the new systems to store and compress the power device, these devices can be very, very small. And that's how they make, for example, the electromagnetic bombs. And after this, I have what I wanted to relate to, but I have to drop first. Yeah, this guy is making me crazy.
Technical point question, Dick, on the subject.
Yeah, somebody's putting the car in. Okay. Maybe before I go into that, John has a technical question. Go ahead.
You got it, John.
Okay, Dick, I just want to make sure I understand something. If I have a capacitor and I charge it with 5 joules of energy, and I hit it later with another 5 joules of energy, you still wind up with only 5 joules stored. Is that correct?
Oh, no. If I put 5 joules of energy into a capacitor, and I can calculate how many joules are there by knowing the capacitance, knowing what voltage it goes to, assuming it starts off uncharged, 1/2 CV² tells you how many joules are there. If I didn't discharge it, and in the same polarity I put in another 5 joules, I now have 10 joules. I don't have twice the voltage. I'll have something like 70% more voltage, or, you know, is it square root of 2 more voltage, because the number of joules is a function of voltage squared. It's very similar to what happens with an automobile. I put a certain amount of energy into my automobile and I go from 0 to 30 miles an hour. I then add the exact same amount of energy into the automobile, a naive person would think I'd go to 60 miles an hour. I'll go to square root of 2 times 30, and maybe it's 43 miles an hour, if you know what I mean. So as you put the same amount of energy into something that's already moving, or in a capacitor that's already charged, you're increasing the energy by the amount of energy you put in, but the voltage goes up by this square root phenomenon, because it's 1/2 CV². I wonder if that makes it a little more sense, John. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Okay, Dick, but that would require increasing the voltage applying that next 5 joules. If the voltage stayed the same, would that capacitor accept another 5 joules?
If you're able to double the microfarads, or the farads, yes. If I can take a charged capacitor that's got 5 joules into it, and if by some magic I can double the number of farads, and then I put that extra energy in there, now I can have 10 joules of the exact same amount of voltage. So it's 1/2 CV², capacitance and farads times voltage squared is joules. Take 1/2 of that product. So if you're not changing the capacitance, you can't increase or decrease the charge without increasing or decreasing the voltage. One of the crazy ones is that in the case of small capacitors that you might be using for a high voltage experiment, where you put a certain number of volts on a capacitor, it's got two plates that are close to each other, and with an insulated tool, you grab one of those plates and you pull the plates apart. The exact same amount of charge is still there. I said charge. Do I mean that? I know that the total amount of energy in the capacitor increases when you separate the plates. The voltage goes up, the capacitance goes down, and the total amount of energy increases because you're doing work on these two plates that are electrostatically attracted to each other when you pull them apart. So there are cases where you add energy and the voltage changes in funny ratios because you're simultaneously changing the capacitance, but on a fixed capacitor, you can't increase or decrease the voltage. You can't increase or decrease the energy without changing the voltage in that direction. That's my belief, John. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick, I thought it worked that way. So if the capacitor value doesn't change and we had a constant voltage generator, We could only charge it to that voltage, and it delivered 5 joules. And we shut off the generator and turned it on again. We're still going to wind up with 5 joules in the same capacitor.
Now I agree. And tell me what you want to do with that one, John. Go ahead.
No, this is in reference to something Wesley and I were discussing earlier about charging at a certain rate and storing it in the capacitor and then hitting it exactly the same again. It's not going to increase the amount of joules in that capacitor. And I just want to make sure I had the concept right before we went any further. But, okay, pick up Wes.
Yeah, those MOX generators, M-A-R-X, and there's some very nice websites on those. A fairly, not very complicated circuit, and by step and repeat, you build a whole lot of these things. You could charge every one of the capacitors on the MOX circuit to, let's say, 1,000 volts, and if you got 10 of these circuits in series with each other, and you discharge one of them, which forces the discharge of all the others because of the way they're wired with a spark gap, you might get 9,000 volts out of the thing where you first charge all the capacitors only to 1,000 volts and there's 10 of them. So it can give you a very brief chunk of very high voltage.
That's how the electromagnetic bomb is being built.
Okay, back to you, Wes.
That's an impulse generator.
Yeah, but this is the concept. I would like to refer you first to two quotes from Nikola Tesla. So we establish first the subject, the essence of generating strong magnetic pulses. Now, by means of a damping wave, but before I go to that, this is the quote. Colorado Springs, Nikola Tesla. I reached 18 million horsepower activities, but that was always by this device. Energy stored in the condenser and discharged in inconceivably small interval of time, you could not produce that activity with an undamped wave. The damped wave is of advantage because it gives you with a generated of 1 kilowatt an activity of 2, 3, 4, and 5,000 kilowatts. Whereas if you have a continuous or undamped wave, 1 kilowatt gives you only wave energy at the rate of 1 kilowatt and nothing more. Now, the second quote of Nikola Tesla is, the elements of the zero period of the periodic, the device for converting capacitor discharges, just column damped wave, Nikola Tesla. A device for converting capacitor discharges, damped wave, I realized that it was a huge benefit break wave at its peak. If I used a custom chopper, he would interrupt the current indiscriminately as low as the high part of the wave. I had two forms of this system. First, where I run interrupt directly from the shaft dynamo, and the other in which I run it through E-synchronous engine. Then the movement of this contact KK, I have sought the exact match the time of the contact so that it occurred precisely at the peak of the wave. This is a form of interruption which is included now in the hundreds of patents and now widely used. Do you have any comments on this two quotes from Nikola Tesla, the Entergia?
We can lead ourselves into misunderstanding if we keep discussing power and not energy. It's my recommendation that we discuss energy into a system and energy back out of the system. Let me give you an example of a capacitor. Assume I've got a 1 farad capacitor, and I decide to charge it at a 1 ampere rate. 1 ampere into 1 farad means that each second that I wait, I'm putting In the beginning, I'm putting in, I guess it's, I have CV spread, either half a joule or one joule in, but anyhow, 1 ampere into a 1 farad capacitor, at the end of 1 second, it'll have 1 volt. At the end of 2 seconds, it'll have 2 volts. At the end of 3 seconds, it'll have 3 volts, and so on. And the rate at which I'm putting energy in is increasing because I'm putting the same amperes across a larger and larger voltage. I'm turning up the power supply, so to speak. But let's just talk about the first 1 second. I put 1 ampere into a capacitor for 1 second, and I've got 1 coulomb of energy in the capacitor, 1 coulomb of charge, and I charged it to 1 ampere. I decide to put my screwdriver across those two terminals, and my screwdriver has a series resistance of 1 milliohm. Well, for a short period of time, I'm going to be getting 1,000 amperes back out. I could calculate the wattage that I'm getting back out, and it's a huge number, but I'm doing it for a very brief time. I'm obeying conservation of energy. The total energy I put in and the energy I get out are going to obey some very basic rules. But if I calculate watts that I'm putting in versus the instantaneous watts that I get back out, I think I'm getting a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I could be putting in 1 watt of energy and getting out 1 kilowatt of energy very, very briefly. So you would think that, gee, I'm multiplying power by 1,000 times. Not really. You come out better if you calculate energy in versus energy out and not watts in versus watts out, because in impulse-type circuits, I can get a tremendous number of watts out, but I can only do it for a very brief period of time. Every one of our pulse-forming networks that you use on a radar transmitter falls into that category. You're charging your capacitor over a long period of time in between the pulses, but each individual radar pulse is a megawatt of power, but only for a microsecond of time. Over to you, Wes, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay, can you refer to what you just said with respect to the damped wave?
Okay, if I charge a capacitor, in my example, it's a 1 farad capacitor, it's a non-polarized capacitor, and I charge it to 1 volt, and now I put across it a one nano Henry inductor. I'm not quite sure what frequency it resonates at, but when I put that 1 nano Henry inductor across that 1 farad capacitor charged to 1 volt, the energy flow in and out of that capacitor, in and out of that inductor, is going to be a huge number. The number of watts flowing in and flowing back out will be a huge number if I choose a big enough capacitor and a small enough inductor. The instantaneous power flow will look like a huge number. But I'm not getting something for nothing. The energy I put into the system and the circulating energy in that inductor and capacitor are going to obey some very basic rules. But the rate of change of watts, of apparent, you know, volt amperes, flowing in and out of that inductor capacitor network when I close that switch will be a huge number. So, assuming now that that's a large amount of current flowing, I can make a very strong magnetic field. I got to be careful with what I use that magnetic field for, because if that magnetic field really does some work, I'm going to be dissipating that energy that's bouncing back and forth in that LC network of my example. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Christian, do you see the reasoning for why Tesla sent it from 1 kilowatt of damped wave, I can reach 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, and 5,000 kilowatts?
I'm going to agree with that as the rate of energy flow from inductor to capacitor and from capacitor back to inductor. And if it was only the magnetic field of that current magnitude that I wanted to produce, that is a way of doing it. I can make a very big cyclic magnetic field in that manner. But now I've got to be careful what I use that magnetic field for. If I'm using that magnetic field to crush a soda can, for instance, and there are people who do that, they get these huge capacitors, charge them up to 10,000 volts, They've got a three-turn coil made out of copper tubing wrapped around a soda can, and they close this humongous switch, and thousands of amperes flows for a couple of microseconds, and that huge magnetic field will crush a can. It'll change the size of a coin. It does, you know, really wild things. You've probably seen that website. I think it's a YouTube video, but there's a website where these kinds of experiments are going on. You're not getting something for nothing. You're taking a large amount of energy that you slowly put into that capacitor. You've discharged it over an extremely short period of time, and that burst of magnetic field allowed you to change the size of a coin or to crush a can. N2XAN, K2LAW.
Comment?
Go ahead, John.
Dick, so what you're saying is joules in versus joules out and accounting for the heat loss and losses, we're going to have exactly the same. Is that right?
Without a doubt. You're not going to get something. This is not a perpetual motion machine. If I calculated watts in and watts out, it would look on the surface like I'm making a huge gain. But if I really calculate joules in versus joules out, you're not going to violate conservation of energy, is my best belief. Over to you, John.
No, very good, Dick. I believe the same thing. Now, the next step is going to be, I think, Wesley's going to say, if we take that, we charge the capacitor, we discharge it in 1/10,000th the time, we can draw a tremendous arc. But we can't reinforce that capacitor quick enough to do it again, so we can't maintain that amplification.
I'm in agreement with that. You cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor, and it's going to really hurt you when you're charging it. When you're discharging it, if you've got a milliohm or a microohm circuit, you get a huge amount of current flow, and it looks like you're instantaneously changing the voltage on the capacitor. Not really. You put the right kind of oscilloscope on there, you will see the slope of the change in dV/dt. And for a very brief period of time, you're going to get a huge amount of watts flowing, or a huge amount of current flowing, or a huge amount of magnetic field. But you're not going to do it with a very high duty factor unless you're backed up by Niagara Falls, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was interested in. Also, I wanted to do this on an XY monitor and use one direction for charge and one for discharge to see what kind of figure I would get on that. But it's interesting, and I was just wondering if Wesley was going that way.
Let's see the same way.
Let's find out. You got it, Wes. Where were you going with this one?
I don't want to shock you guys. I have purchased Advantech Electro Systems a generator. Now, taking various samples of the generators, there is nothing inside. This thing works only to 1 megahertz and is capable of nanoseconds, half of a nanosecond or 5 nanoseconds of rise time of an impulse. What is happening is that in the full time, that this thing could handle 150 amps, 170 volts, and it does not have any sink for the transistors. And if even in some verses, the MOSFETs I employed in it, these MOSFETs do not have a sink heat sink on it. Maybe it's up. Okay, so because the generator wasn't really working, I look inside and I was kind of shocked with it, and with that what the manufacturer says about it. So with the capacitor, we have a huge current and huge voltage on it, and the capacitor is not discharged. That's what we established so far. Yes, Dick?
Assume now that I've got a very large DC voltage on a pretty big capacitor. I got a lot of joules stored. And now I got the right kind of switching device. Maybe they're really powerful field effect transistors or whatever. For short periods of time, I can generate large amounts of current output into some kind of a load, a very low resistance or low inductance load. And I can make briefly a very strong magnetic field. But the